was clear. I saw myself as an artist potentially on his team, a singer and songwriter with the full freedom to evolve. "Look," he said, "I think you're absolutely phenomenal, and I'd love to sign you to Arista, but Columbia would be crazy to let you out of your contract. There's no way in the world they're going to let you go." Jeff insisted otherwise. "Leave that to me," he told Clive. Near the start of 1999, Jeff somehow pulled off the miracle he had promised. Behind the scenes, he at last talked Columbia into both releasing me from my contract and selling my masters to Arista. It was one hell of a fight. But Clive believed so strongly in our future partnership that he was willing to buy me out of my deal for a hefty sum of about $500,000. Months later, when Clive's professional world was shaken from all sides, I'd have my chance to partially repay him for his faith in me. When you've chosen the right path for yourself, you usually know it immediately. The choice just sits right in your spirit. You're not second-guessing your decision or thinking about turning back. You realize there are challenges ahead, but you're not looking over your shoulder wishing you'd gone left instead of right at the last fork in the road. It was with this sweet assurance that I moved ahead with Clive. On the day I signed the contract, all my internal bells and whistles and dancing emojis shouted, "Yes!" The transition to Arista provided me with a pause, an opportunity for the seasoning to settle on my creations before I presented them robust with flavor to the world. The tentative plan was to roll out the album in 2000. With input from Jeff and Peter about possible new sounds and collaborations I could include, I returned to the studio in a new headspace. Finally, I could exhale and focus solely on creating. It felt like freedom. I'm often asked where my melodies and lyrics come from. I may never fully comprehend how a song sprouts from nothingness into existence, and truthfully, I'm not tempted to decode the mystery. I hope to be constantly surprised, in amazement of how the tiny seed of a possible chord or lyric miraculously springs to life. That unexplainable process, that alchemy, is part of what separates art from logic and reason. I don't create from a set of rules or formulas. I tap into my true feelings and experiences and allow them to guide me. Creativity is inherently messy. It's chaotic and nonlinear. It comes to life in fits and starts, disjointed and seemingly random. That chaos, for me, often begins with a fleeting inspiration, a sudden burst of an idea or sound. The spark might come from a line I've read in a novel, a conversation I've overheard, or an abiding sense of calm I felt during a Sunday stroll through Harlem's Mount Morris Park. In the case of the latter, I might return home, sit down at the piano, and play around with some chords that embody the feeling I've experienced. Or I might hear a beautiful chord in a song and think, "What key is that?" and later try to pick it out on my keyboard. The chord might lead me to a different set of chords, which might later become the foundation for a melody. Other times I may have some lyrics scribbled down on a random piece of paper with no idea how they may fit together with notes. I can never predict how the music will come to me. I only know that once a song has fully revealed itself, its face is somehow a reflection of my experience. To create a great song, my friend, songwriter Van Hunt, has often said, "All you really need is three chords and the truth." Troubles is that kind of truth. In the tunnel of anxiety I navigated in my early months at Columbia, I glimpsed little hope in the distance. The thought of creating a finished album, given the circumstances, completely unnerved me. I was alone a lot that winter. When I felt myself slipping into a dark place, I'd sometimes escape to my mother's place and channel my anxiety into songwriting. The next morning back at the Harlem apartment, I'd wake up and remember just how lost and confused I was. I'd lay there watching the light stream through the window bars, casting its long and ominous shadows. "Dear Lord, can you take it away?" I wrote out one morning. "This pain in my heart that follows me day by day, and at night it stalks me like the shadows on my wall. Real pain, real shadows, real sentiments that became the lyrics of a song I once considered titling A Conversation with God because it so clearly expressed all of the anxieties and frustrations of the time. The verses were my doubts. The chorus was God speaking. Once those words came to me, my fingers landed on a trio of chords that seemed to express my mood. I played those chords over and over, hypnotized by the progression. As the song developed, Carrie and I made our way through Harlem, with me clutching a DAT machine to record the sounds of the city. The squeal of sirens, the shouts of bystanders, the roar of traffic along Malcolm X Boulevard, the rumble of the 2 or 3 train underground to use as background on the recording. "Yeah, I'ma take it nice and slow," some guy yelled out. Carrie and I traded a glance and then a smile, as we both had the same thought. We knew exactly where we could slide that in, which we did. My dear sister friend Tanisha and I wrote The Life together, with me on piano and her on bass. I'm convinced that in some other existence, I was a child of the 60s and 70s. The sounds and fashion trends of both eras have always resonated with me. The music is so sonically lush, so layered and interesting, so alive and funky. Artists like Curtis Mayfield and Nina Simone weren't focused on creating a pop hit. Their intention was to reflect their surroundings, and that comes through in their songs. I've heard Mayfield's Superfly album a million times, and when I listen to it even now, I'm still blown away by every horn, every guitar string, every roll of the piano keys, every story reverberating through the bass lines. Curtis brought together real musicians, each a master at his or her own instrument. There is no substitute for such a collaboration, no electronic enhancement that can replace the sound of multiple musicians gathered together in one room. My team and I definitely use modern gear like Pro Tools and drum machines to create a foundation with keyboards and virtual sounds, but on top of that bass, we layer in the human element, which gives the music its retro-futuristic feel. Digital equipment has so much to offer, and yet humanity can never be faked. The spirit flows through every drum and guitar, through every note of every chorus. The life was my attempt at capturing that spirit. Carrie and I brought in instrumentalists to create a song that pays musical homage to the neighborhood that raised me. Sometimes a song's concept is solidified in my mind, long before the melody and lyrics come together. When I was still signed with Columbia, I once spent Thanksgiving in North Carolina with Michael Mauldin and his family. After a massive, delicious meal that made me very sleepy, I flopped down on the couch to watch some television. A L'Oreal hair color commercial came on. Toward the end of the ad, the model uttered the brand's trademark slogan, "Because you're worth it." I'd seen that commercial countless times, but for whatever reason in that particular moment, the message struck me, and it was exactly the idea I wanted to convey in a song. Later in the studio, I put that sentiment to music for a song we called A Woman's Worth. During my first months with Columbia, I'd started falling. I'd wanted to create my own melody, but one with a similar energy to songs from the 60s, something like the Jackson 5 would sing. I can imagine little Michael throwing back his head on stage, singing about crazy deep experiences he surely knew nothing about at his age. I messed around with some ideas, but nothing seemed to gel, so I set my efforts aside. Meanwhile, I may not have been actively working on a song, but it continued working on me. A piece of a lyric or a couple of notes or chords would come to me here and there, while I moved around our makeshift Harlem studio. Fast forward to my transition to Arista. Carrie and I, as well as Jeff and the label team, all felt the album was still missing something. That one song that would raise the hair on your arms and make people listen. So a few months before my album's release, I pulled out my early draft of Fallen. My relationship with Carrie definitely prompted the lyrics of Fallen, and yet the song is more than a testimony to our connection. What is true in most romances was true in ours. The journey is riddled with curves and U-turns, valleys and mountaintops. One of the many things that initially drew me to Carrie was how wholeheartedly he embraced his responsibilities as a dad. He cared for and provided for his biological son, and he'd also maintained a real fatherly connection with his ex's first son from a previous relationship. Though Carrie's boys didn't live with us, they were around the apartment a lot. As much as I loved having them there, both in the apartment and as a big part of my life, I also found it difficult to balance with everything else I had going on. I was still so young myself, and slipping into the role of stepmother was a lot for me to handle, especially against the backdrop of creating an album while establishing my own sense of independence for the first time. I also wasn't the greatest communicator then, and neither was Carrie. Growing up in a house where my own voice was seldom the loudest one, I hadn't yet learned how to speak my truth. So if something bothered me, I struggled with articulating that to Carrie, and as I'd done during childhood, I'd escape to my piano or my journal. Then, after months of nursing resentment, my feelings would come crashing to the surface, and following an argument, I'd draw even further inward. I'd then flee to my mother's apartment and stay there for a few days so I could sort out my feelings. At one point, Carrie and I even broke up for several months, and I rented my own place. One minute, the energy and connection between us would be incredible, and the next, we'd be escaping to our own corners. It was hard. It was easy. It was difficult again. Then just as I'd be on the verge of backing away once more, I'd remember all the things I loved about this man. His desire, always, to protect me, his kind and gracious manner, and especially his spiritual openness. Though I hadn't grown up in a church, my mother, whose parents raised her Catholic, instilled in me an understanding of myself as God's child. And I have always carried with me a deep feeling of connection to and respect for all living things. In a way, because I wasn't brought up in any one particular tradition, I've had the freedom to explore the thread of truth that I believe runs through all of them. Carrie, through his own spiritual exploration and our ongoing conversations, expanded my awareness. He exposed me to the universal law of cause and effect, of how the energy we put out always circles back to us, of how our intentions, words, and actions create our reality. It was Carrie who first opened my eyes to the power of words. With my luck, I'd often say, this will never work out. Why do you always say that? He finally cut in. It's just a phrase, I insisted, shrugging it off. Growing up, I'd heard my mother use that phrase repeatedly, and I'd adopted it. You should stop saying that, Carrie told me. It might have sounded like a joke, he explained, but it was actually a reflection of my belief that things would always turn out badly for me, that I was doomed no matter what, that my so-called luck would always be unfavorable. And by putting those words out there, I was attracting the energy of failure. What we repeat is who we ultimately become. I banned "with my luck" from my vocabulary. Our shared interest in these ideas lived at the center of our relationship, but it wasn't the strongest glue. The real magnet was our love for music. That's what powerfully drew us back together over and over. We set aside all else, including any personal disagreements, when it came to our focus on the album. We carried on with making music, even during the most difficult days at Columbia. Fallen is also about that tough chapter, that transition from one label to the next. As good as it felt to sign on with Clive's team, that whole period still brought a lot of uncertainty. When exactly would my album, this set of songs I'd already lived with for so many years, finally debut? What alterations did I still need to make? Would listeners love my baby, my personal work, as much as I'd come to cherish it? Fallen captures the spirit of those questions, of the ups and downs and doubts and unpredictability. Nothing but uncertainty is certain. Circumstances come together only to fall apart moments or months later, and then in a flash, we must rise up and regain our footing. In the rearview mirror, I now see so clearly what escaped me then. It's not that the ground underneath me was suddenly shifting. It's that it is never still. That's part of the work of my journey, getting comfortable with life's groundlessness. The year 2000 ushered in another big change. There was a lot happening behind the scenes. The team at Bertelsmann Music Group, BMG, Arista's parent company, asked Clive to trade his top spot at the label for a position as chairman of worldwide A&R for BMG. If he made that move, however, he would no longer have equity participation in the company and would lose his share in the profits. Clive, blindsided by the request, refused to make that change without continuing in profit shares. To keep from losing him, BMG offered him a historic amount of funding, $150 million, to start his own label, J Records, and that label would be distributed through BMG. Clive was able to take with him 10 artists in total, 5 platinum or multi-platinum artists, and 5 totally unknown. But there were, of course, some caveats. Those 10 artists had to decide on their own whether they'd move, and Clive could not offer them better terms than those in place in their Arista contracts. Arista, however, could sweeten the deal as much as they wanted to entice artists to remain at the label. At Arista, record executive L.A. Reid took the top spot. Initially, there was no question in my mind which direction I'd take. I'd, of course, follow Clive to his new label. Peter Edge, who'd supported me from the start of my career, had already followed Clive to J Records. Clive made it abundantly clear that he'd love to continue our partnership and would make me a priority at the new label. Done and done. But then, L.A., who years earlier had expressed interest in one day working with me, put a killer financial offer on the table, and that suddenly made my choice feel less straightforward. Jeff, who knew that opportunities like this didn't come up very often, felt strongly about getting the best financial offer while it was in front of us. "Let's go with L.A., he said to me. Jeff and I debated for days. I can still feel the below-freezing wind gusts cutting through my jacket and into my bones as I stood out on 57th Street arguing with him about why I wanted to remain with Clive. "Come on," Jeff kept saying. "Let's just do the deal with Arista. Clive is great. L.A. is great. Both understand who you are as an artist. So either way, you win professionally. You might as well go with the best deal." As much as I understood and appreciated that logic, and as eager as I was to carve out a Grand Canyon between me and an empty checking account, I didn't feel good about walking away from Clive. He clearly cared about my career. I'd sensed that from our very first meeting. He'd also invested mightily in helping me untangle myself from Columbia. I also felt loyal to Peter, who'd wanted to sign me from the beginning, long before the universe brought us together at Arista. "I'm staying with Clive," I finally told Jeff, who rolled his eyes and threw up his arms. My instincts had led me to sign with Clive, and now that sixth sense urged me to remain loyal to our partnership. For one of the first times in my relationship with my manager, I refused to be swayed. In the coming years, he'd often say to me, "I will never doubt your instincts." Songs in A Minor was finally given a release date, June 2001. At the new label, Jeff, Peter, Clive, and the team immediately began laying the groundwork for a spectacular rollout. In the months leading up to the big debut, they found every opportunity they could to provide me with a stage. They were intent on creating a groundswell of interest by raising my visibility and letting others discover me, one performance at a time. In those days, radio promotion was critical to an album's success. So Clive assembled 10 of the country's most influential promoters at his Park Avenue apartment and brought me in to play for them. If he was asked to speak at an industry event, he took me along and talked me up. To understand who Alicia is as an artist, he'd often say, you have to see her perform live. And there I would be, a 20-year-old with braids and beads, with a large helping of soul and a sprinkle of classical. Ahead of the album's release, I had one last box to check, and the thought of it made the hairs on the back of my neck rise up in unison. One of my songs, How Come You Don't Call Me, was a cover of a song written by an artist I'd spent my whole childhood idolizing, Prince. Before I could include the cover song on my album, I needed personal permission from a legend who I heard seldom granted others the okay to use his material. In spring of 2001, I set out to try. You don't just dial up the royal one. Jeff first had to connect me with someone on Prince's team, and I'm sure that person then sent us a secret phone number that would disintegrate 5 seconds after we'd read it. I gathered my courage and dialed the number, which, of course, wasn't Prince's direct line. The nice woman who answered put me on hold before transferring me to another line. 3 additional transfers later, I finally heard that raspy, instantly recognizable voice. Hello? Hi, I chirped a bit too enthusiastically in an attempt to disguise my shaky voice. What the hell do I say to one of the most celebrated musicians on the planet? I've been watching what you're doing, he told me. My heart nearly fell out of my chest. Really? I said incredulously. Yeah, really, he said. It's cool. So, are you writing and producing your own music? I told him I was. That's great, he told me. Keep that up. I thanked him for his advice, cleared my throat, and then shifted into the purpose of my call. So, I'm doing a cover of your song, How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore? I explained. It's one of my all-time favorite songs, like, ever. And I was wondering if I could use it on my album. Silence. Why don't you come play at Paisley Park? He said. I paused. You want me to come play at Paisley Park? Sure, he said. You should come down. I can show you the place, and then you can play the song for me. Weeks later, I was standing at the outer gates of Prince's gray concrete 65,000-square-foot fortress in Chanhassen, Minnesota, shivering in the too-thin leather jacket I'd been wearing all winter. A staff member graciously welcomed us at the front door, and moments later, Prince sashayed toward us down a long hall, his heels clicking with each one of his smooth diddy-bop steps. He greeted me with a handshake. Thanks for coming, he said. Let me show you around. Visiting the mansion was like reliving some of the most iconic moments of Prince's illustrious career. The walls were covered with memorabilia, from his old guitars and framed platinum records and sheet music to the costumes he wore in 1984's Purple Rain. In one room sat a grand piano, its top engraved with the lyrics of How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore. In several other rooms sat even more pianos, all as stunningly unique as their owner. We passed a cage full of cooing white doves, a head nod to one of his most enduring musical creations. At nearly every turn were recording studios and exquisitely designed lounge spaces with overstuffed leather couches. And, as you might expect, there was purple all around. A lot of it. We rounded the corner into the performance space, a sprawling yet somehow intimate room about the size of a school gymnasium. A couple hundred people, a group of superfans Prince often invited in for performances, were already gathered. Before my backup singers and I began setting up for our sound check, Prince pulled me aside. "I only have one request for you," he said. "No cursing allowed. That's my one ask." "I'll try," I said, nodding and blushing. Prince sat in the corner, hidden from my view, as I, with my black fedora, propped over one eye and my fingertips sweaty on the keyboard, lifted the rafters with my first note of Fallin'. I played every song on my album, including the one that had brought me to Paisley Park. Afterward, Prince met us backstage in the dressing room. "Great show, great sound," he told us as we beamed. On our way out, he pulled me aside again. "You're going to have to put a dollar in my curse jar," he said, a grin spreading across his pale face. No, I hadn't dropped the F-bomb, but I had committed a couple of minor infractions. I laughed and thanked him, and he saw me out. Later, back at the hotel, I did not sleep a wink. What just happened to me? Is it really over? Can I go back? I did not want my dream trip to end. Prince was gracious enough to grant me the right to use his song, but that wasn't the greatest permission he extended. With his very presence, his wild sense of individualism, and his determination to define himself in a world eager to do that for you, Prince stood for self-ownership. He stood for conscious and full-throated defiance. He stood for freedom and creative expression, for rule-breaking, rule-making, and imagination. And that summer, as I stepped onto the grandest stage of my lifetime, Prince stood in spirit with me. Chapter 6, World Stage. Let's start with these wise words from my mentor and friend, Clive Davis.
In February 2001, a few months before the release of Songs in A Minor, I hosted my pre-Grammy Gala, the three-hour show that I put on every year. It's the hottest ticket in town, filled with A-listers from across the entire entertainment world. "I've got good news and I've got bad news," I said to Alicia before the gathering. "The good news is I don't traditionally include new artists at my gala, but I'm going to create a best new artist category and ask you to sing." She was thrilled. "And what's the bad news?" she asked. "Angie Stone is performing right before you, and one of her selections incorporates a sampling of Neither One of Us, the great Gladys Knight song. Gladys will be in the audience, and I'll ask her to come up and join Angie on her rendition of the song. The bad news is that I can't let Gladys leave the stage without doing Midnight Train to Georgia. I'll, of course, introduce Gladys as one of the all-time greats, right up there with Aretha and Streisand. And after she sings, it seems to me a wonderful time to go from a legend to a brand new artist. So you're going to follow Gladys Knight. It's a measure of Alicia's confidence, grace, and maturity that she said, "I get it, and I'll just have to do the absolute best that I can. I'll give you my best." Gladys, of course, brought down the house. And then Alicia got up on stage and gave a riveting, breathtaking performance of Fallin'. That brought the crowd to its feet again. Not only was she creatively brilliant, She was also her own best ambassador.
Classical music has always given me the shakes. Even as a child, whenever I had to perform an intricate Bach or Chopin or Brahms composition, I'd work myself into a tizzy, rehearsing feverishly for hours, the whole time fearing I'd freeze up at showtime. Once on stage for the recital, there I'd sit, hands quivering and feet shaking on the pedals, racing through the labyrinth of opening notes as Mom and Nana and Fafa held their breath and willed me to stay on course. After I made it through the first measure, I could usually relax a little. And over the years, during any performance that included a classical piece, I even learned to breathe my way through the full experience and enjoy it. But in June 2001, as I stepped onto the stage above all stages, the set of the Oprah Winfrey Show, my tremors returned. Just a few months earlier, Fallen had been released, but soon ran into resistance. We first released it to R&B, but even in the urban market, the song wasn't getting nearly as much airtime as we'd hoped. And it had to break through in urban before pop would even consider it. The reception among listeners was mixed. People didn't quite know what to make of my sound, which had a retro soul, throwback feel to it. My opening measures of Fallen brought a certain visual to mind. A jazz crooner from a bygone era, maybe a Billie Holiday or an Etta James type, singing about a long-lost lover. Radio DJs didn't quite get it, and they played the song less and less as time went on. Clive moved quickly to intervene. He had every incentive to ensure that my lead single and the forthcoming album struck lightning. Songs in A Minor was not only the launch of my solo career, it also had the potential to further establish the reputation of Clive's new venture, J Records. A lot was riding on this moment for both of us. So with the combination of zeal and determination that fueled Clive's rise to the top of his industry, he decided to do something he'd never done for any other artist. He asked Oprah to book me on her show. Clive had known Oprah for years, and yet he didn't just pick up the phone. Instead, he penned a persuasive letter, one in which he referred to me as so special and so unique and clearly an all-timer that I felt I really must personally bring her to your attention. He realized, he explained, that Oprah usually showcased established artists, which was understandable, but he proposed that she do for up-and-coming musicians what she had already done for so many first-time authors, provide them with a platform to connect with her millions of viewers. And yes, he wanted her to feature me, the 21-year-old classical pianist with shaky hands right at center stage. Clive realized that, like others, Oprah needed to see me perform in order to truly take in my whole vibe. So along with his letter, he enclosed a video, one that featured me at the piano with my full passion and artistry on display. In response to the letter, the show's executive producer called Clive. Oprah had watched the video and wanted to have me on the show, the producer explained, but her team was developing the show's concept. As they talked through possibilities, Clive suggested building an episode around the crop of rising neo-soul artists like Jill Scott, India Arie, and me. He hadn't worked with Jill or India, but admired them both greatly. The producer, who liked the approach, later widened the scope by adding some gospel singers to the lineup, Yolanda Adams and Mary Mary. Meanwhile, I had no idea the stars were aligning in my favor. On the afternoon, Jeff told me that Clive had booked me on Oprah and that my performance of Fallen would close out the show. I just about passed out. "I'm playing my song on Oprah's show?" I kept asking to be sure I'd heard him correctly. "Yes," he said, beaming, "and it's next week." Let me take you back to 2001, the year when Oprah's show was already 15 seasons into its 25-season run at number one in the ratings. There was no stage more powerful, no cultural touchstone that compared. Movements were launched on Oprah's set. The book publishing industry was revolutionized. Wild dreams took flight. Ugly tears were shed. Favorite things were handed out to scores of squealing audience members. And stitched right into the show's DNA was a quest for truth, for light bulb moments and epiphanies that altered the trajectories of those who tuned in. It was a daily collective gathering at the well, an hour when mothers, daughters, sisters, friends, and more than a few woke men came together from every corner of the globe. I'd grown up watching Oprah after school, in between homework and piano practice, and it was always on at my nana's house. But you didn't need to see the show every day to feel a part of its magic. It spilled over into the headlines and reverberated through kitchen table conversations and hair salon gab fests. And I was about to become part of that phenomenon. Heart, be still. Fingers, too. The universe was clearly on my side because it sent me a small miracle. I got to meet Oprah before showtime. When Clive had first connected with Oprah's producer, she asked him, "How good is Alicia in person?" Clive assured her I was a compelling live performer. She took him at his word, and as a result, Oprah invited me to sing at a dinner she was hosting for a group of her major national advertisers. The gathering in Chicago was a few days ahead of my big appearance. When I arrived, Oprah's warm, "Hey girl," greeting immediately took the edge off my nervousness, but only the top edge. I made it through that evening without a hiccup, and the crowd embraced my performance, and yet the real test awaited soon after. More than anything, I wanted to rise to the moment to honor the opportunity I'd been given with a performance worthy of Oprah's stage. Still a tomboy at heart, I pulled together my version of a Sunday best outfit, a tux jacket with satin penguin wings. I'd had my hair freshly done for the occasion, and my signature zigzag cornrows finished off with beads cascading down my back. In my sparkly Cesare Paciotti sneakers, I stepped foot on the set, one of the first I'd been on. I peered around, hardly stopping to blink, with one thought reeling through my head. I'm literally inside of the television right now. That's just how brand new I was. As I took my seat at the piano and placed my hands on the keys, the shakes made their debut. I was smiling on the outside, but my insides were screaming, "What the hell is happening?" I inhaled deeply and began with Beethoven's Für Elise, doing all I could to stave off the trembles. With each passing measure, I could feel the stress exiting from my fingertips as I thought, just get through one more bar, and then another, and then another. I hit the opening chord for Fallen, and a momentary hush fell over the audience. I then leaned back, closed my eyes, summoned my first note from the farthest corner of my soul, and I sang into the microphone. I keep on falling in. And that's when the universe took over. Something supernatural happens when you give in to the energy of a song. You momentarily forget you're performing, and you just lean into the music's vibration. There you sit, curled up in the notes, allowing them to lift you heavenward. That was my experience. On Oprah's public stage, I had a private hallelujah moment. Never mind that millions were watching, I was just gone, ascending to someplace beyond the stars. As the spirit took hold, it transported me to my mother's living room, to an afternoon when I played at my battered upright, amazed at music's inexplicable power. What pulled me back to the present was the audience's applause. Afterward, Oprah joined me on stage. "You've been writing your own music since you were 14?" she asked me. 14, I repeated. "Definitely. There was no other path for me. I knew this was my path. I had to follow it." "I noticed you wrote and produced every single song on the CD except for Prince's," she said. I nodded and grinned. That is amazing, she declared with her trademark enthusiasm, sprinkling her fairy godmother stardust in my direction. Your first CD. I blushed. It's important for me to properly express how I feel at the moment and not have it filtered through other people, I told her. It just feels natural for me to say how I feel at the moment. And to be in charge of your life, Oprah responded. Oh, you're a woman after my own heart. Then she threw her arm around my shoulder and faced the red blinking light of the camera. Okay, Alicia Keys, she said as the credits rolled and the audience cheered. Thanks, Clive. Not long after, the heavens parted. Songs in A Minor debuted at number one on the charts, selling 263,000 copies in the first week, another 450,000 copies in the second, and eventually more than 16 million copies around the world. Fallen went from struggling at radio to climbing into the top position on the charts. During the show, Oprah was spotted singing along to Fallen. The world took her cue and gave the song a place in the sun. And I, the Hell's Kitchen girl carrying a dream twice my size, stood in gratitude as the wonder unfolded. Aren't you Alicia Keys? An 80-something-year-old white man leaned in and whispered to me. I was on my flight home to New York after Oprah's show, still in my dream state and floating high above the 30,000 feet our plane had climbed to. Yes, I said, trying to recall where I'd met this man. He cleared up the mystery. I just saw you on the Oprah show. That sentence heralded my entrance into the strange land called fame. There was no easing into this new country. The transformation was at once rapid and surprising. The morning before my Oprah appearance, I'd been a relatively unknown artist who spent years composing and polishing my album. The very same day, my stroll to the airport spurred 100 head turns as I wondered why people were suddenly staring at me. It felt like the moment in Dreamgirls when seemingly overnight, the group leaps from obscurity to center stage. What happens in the movies isn't supposed to happen in real life. And yet, it is exactly what happened to me. If I'd been under the impression that only a certain segment of the world's population tuned into Oprah show, that notion was flatly overturned. The variety of people who approached me proved just how enormous and varied the show's cross-section of viewers were. Young and old, male and female, Latina and Asian, black and white, rural and urban. Some just gawked but didn't say anything. Others asked for my autograph. Many more came up to me exclaiming, hand over mouth, some version of the refrain I'd hear repeatedly in the coming months. Oh my gosh, I just saw you on Oprah! I remember the first time I tried to walk around my old neighborhood. At Mom's apartment, I threw on my sweats and wandered out onto 8th Avenue, probably in search of my fake ID place because I still hadn't reached my 21st birthday. I got two steps out of the building's revolving door before a delivery man, there to take up someone's lunch, stopped, set down his bag, and exclaimed, "You were on TV last week!" From that moment to the time I arrived at the little shop, seemingly every person did a double take upon spotting me. The zigzag chunky braids were a giveaway, and once I got hip to that, I tried disguising myself under a hat and big sunglasses that covered two-thirds of my face. The ploy didn't work, and in fact, it made it super obvious I was hiding. One woman marched up to me and said, "Is that Alicia Keys under that hat?" Busted. This sea change felt as thrilling as it did humbling. On most days, I glided around in a happiness high, a giddiness brought on by triumph's sweet elixir. The accolades poured in, each one more incredible than the last. That September, I was invited to perform Fallen at the Metropolitan Opera House in Manhattan's Lincoln Center for the MTV Video Music Awards. For its November issue, Rolling Stone hailed me the next Queen of Soul and put me on its cover in a cropped T-shirt proudly displaying my city's name as a tribute to New York right after 9/11. The following January, my album's second single, A Woman's Worth, made it into the top 10 on the charts. For me, the utter elation of this period came from the world's embrace of my creation, my music. No feeling compares to having others love what you love, and then enthusiastically sharing it with others. Fame for the sake of fame had never been a dream, but spreading light is a pleasure I'll always live for. Kerry was on cloud 49. Even prior to the 6 years we'd spent creating, shaping, and refining songs in A minor, he'd been in search of his own unique place in music's universe. The year the album hit, he was overjoyed to at last celebrate the strong sense of fulfillment brought on by his work on the album. "You know that song you wrote with Alicia?" fans would often say to him after noticing his name in the credits. "That song changed my life." What's far more satisfying than being known is feeling purposeful. That was true for both of us. Soon after Songs in A Minor dropped, I went on tour with Maxwell, the neo-soul prince with the buttery smooth vocals. Our 25-date 14-city tour kicked off in New York and looped its way through cities including Chicago, Atlanta, and Minneapolis. Maxwell, of course, was the main event. I, the newbie on the ticket, warmed up the crowd by opening the show with a medley from my album. When your album rockets to the top of the charts, you're not instantly loaded. While on the Maxwell tour, I was still living on the advance money I'd received years earlier upon signing with Columbia. I'd also gotten a payment when I transitioned to Arista, but because Clive had to spend so much to get me out of my old deal, my second advance was relatively modest. With my earnings from the Maxwell tour, as well as my own tour to follow in the spring of 2002, my income had increased enough to make me financially comfortable, but not as wealthy as some might imagine. Enter the world of commissions, that percentage of royalties that managers, lawyers, agents, and other handlers earn as a part of their professional partnership with an artist. At the time, I had no idea just how much of my pay wasn't making it into my savings account. In part, that was because I was allowing others to commission me on my pre-tax, pre-expense, gross income. So, if I made $100, 30 or more of those dollars might go to commissions. With the $70 I had left, I then had to cover all expenses that came with managing my tour and my business, plus settle up with Uncle Sam. You've heard the tragic stories of musicians whose tours gross millions and yet they somehow end up without a pot to piss in. How does that happen? It happens when you take your eye off the intricacies of your business. And when you know better, you hopefully do better. Those early years taught me how to do better real fast. I've always been financially conservative. My mother worked hard for her money and spent it carefully, and she taught me to do the same. The music equipment that I'd invested in after signing the deal with Columbia had been my first major purchase. Later, after finally getting my driver's license at 18, I leased a gold Mazda 626 in order to get around. A few years into our work on the first album, Kerry and I had outgrown his one-bedroom crib, not to mention that our 3 a.m. jam sessions were annoying the hell out of the neighbors. That reality coincided with my desire for some space of a different kind, a little breathing room in our relationship during a time when we were working through some challenges. So Kerry kept the apartment, and I moved over the bridge to Jersey. I immediately regretted that decision, because the daily toll to cross the George Washington Bridge took a big bite out of my budget at the time. A few months later, I moved into a family's basement in Ozone Park, Queens, and that gave me a toll-free ride over the Queensboro Bridge. I stayed there for a hot minute before Kerry and I reconnected and together relocated to a small house in Rosedale, Queens. I used my Arista advance to purchase that house, which had enough space for us to both live and work. The equipment, the Mazda, the home, All were smart investments in getting my album off the ground. Songs in A minor improved my financial picture, but it didn't significantly change how I handled my money. Every ka-ching triggered in me a long-held fear, followed by a question, if all of this suddenly goes away, have I saved enough to be okay? I'd seen how quickly circumstances could shift, as fast as they once had when my mother lost her father and the family's breadwinner, and I was determined not to end up as the penniless bag lady, the former star whose downward spiral left her in dire financial straits. So in the early days of my career, I was very, very careful with cash. And when I did buy something for myself, I never went for flashy. In place of $5,000 designer boots or Bentleys, I opted for white t-shirts and Tims I could get for cheap on 125th Street. I'll never forget the first time I went to Bergdorf Goodman, the luxury department store on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. Erica, my childhood friend, who later worked on my team as my day-to-day manager, was with me. Following the album and tour, I'd just received my first major check. I deposited it and didn't touch it for weeks. You should go shopping, Erica urged me. I reluctantly agreed. It can't hurt to look, I figured. And maybe it was time for a small indulgence. If you've ever roamed the aisles of Bergdorf's, then you understand how forcefully desire can grab you by the throat. You quickly go from swearing you don't need a single thing to lusting after designer sneakers you hadn't even known existed before the moment you spotted them. Within a half hour in the store, I'd picked out a pair of shoes, a leather jacket, a scarf, and a killer belt. When the lady at the counter announced the total, "That will be $3,482," she said without blinking. I looked blankly at her. "I'm putting all this back," I whispered to Erica as I scooped up the items and left the register. "This is ridiculous. I can't pay this much." "Come on," Erica pressed. "You should do something nice for yourself for once." I stared at her but didn't respond. "Do you love these?" she asked, picking up the sneakers I just propped back up onto their display stand. I nodded. "Well, if you really love them," she went on, "you should buy them. It's time to celebrate a little." I ultimately bought two of the five items, the high-top sneakers and the leather jacket. And for days after the purchase, I was in turmoil. Not just because I'd still spent over $1,000, an insane amount in my view, but also because I should have gotten that belt. Months later, when I went back for it, the item had been discontinued. Erica wasn't pushing me to live beyond my means. Rather, she was nudging me toward a different mindset, a mentality that was foreign to me. I'd grown up in survival mode, clutching tightly to every dollar that came my way. And when you spend from a belief that every cent you earn will be your last, you operate from a place of scarcity, a context that runs counter to the energy of abundance. Money, like all life, is an energy exchange. You give yourself over to whatever you're passionate about, and what comes back to you is energy in the form of monetary compensation. You attract more or less of what you want by how you choose to interact with it, as well as what you believe about yourself. Do you truly feel you deserve what you're asking for? Are you worth it? How you answer impacts what comes your way. None of this means you should foolishly squander your paycheck in Bergdorf's. Rather, it's about seeing money through a spiritual lens rather than a physical one. Erica, who'd always been as connected to the spiritual side of life as Carrie is, understood this principle. Her parents were entrepreneurs who ran a successful headhunting firm and had exposed her to smart spending and investing strategies. As an adult on her own journey, she'd also come to understand money management based on the universal law of attraction. What you focus on expands. If you focus on the goodness in your life, you create more of it. If you live with an open palm rather than a closed fist, you leave room for immeasurable blessings to flow through your hands. It was one of the strongest lessons Erica passed on to me in the classroom my life was becoming. Speaking of lessons, I collected another one during my first tour. Let your mother be your mother and never your assistant. When I brought Mom on board to help me on the road, she was so fiercely protective of me that I began jokingly calling her my bulldog. She'd go off on a publicist who was insisting that I do one last round of interviews after I'd already done 10 of them. She clearly wasn't aiming to collect the Miss Congeniality Award. Her sole mission was to guard my space. I appreciated her mama bear instinct, but to keep from offending everyone in the industry, I had to ask her to chill. "So, am I fired?" she asked me, grinning. She wasn't, or at least not right away. For me, the turning point came when I watched my beautiful mother crawl into one of those tiny lower pods on our tour bus. Why the hell do I have my mom in a bunk bed? I thought. It didn't feel right, nor did our arrangement as mother and assistant. We eventually both realized that we were better at being family than we were at being colleagues. And that meant hiring an assistant who hadn't given birth to me. In December 2001, I received an early Christmas present. I was nominated for not just one Grammy, but 6 of them, including one for Fallen as Song of the Year. Jon Stewart was tapped to host the ceremony at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, and I, still floating someplace above the atmosphere upon hearing of the nominations, was asked to perform. I was battling the flu on the day of the show, but I willed myself out of bed. I wasn't about to miss my first Grammys, even if my face crashed right down onto the piano keys. My voice was hoarse, much too raspy to make it through the opening notes of Fallen. I was freaking out. So that morning, a doctor gave me a vitamin B12 shot right in the ass, the long needle stinging me so badly that I cupped my hand over my mouth as he pulled it out. I don't know whether the dose of B12 had anything to do with it, but my voice was restored, at least temporarily. Even with the recovery of my voice, my brain felt caught between a sick fog and a dream fog throughout the whole day. A heady exhilaration mixed with the haziness brought on by meds. The iconic stylist Patti Wilson dressed me. Even with my foggy brain, I held on to the clear idea I'd had from the beginning. I wanted to mix a dress with jeans, a combo of street and glam that reflected my vibe. Patti got my vision immediately. She draped me in a seafoam green Christian Dior slip dress, overlaying a white tee and jeans. My makeup artist finished off the look by super gluing jewels on my eyelids. I loved the touch of bling, but those fake diamonds were heavy as hell. If you look closely at the footage of me on stage, I looked like I developed a sudden case of sleepy eye. I could barely keep my lids open. My trip down the red carpet shifted the day's surrealism into fifth gear. As I made my way through, I couldn't believe I was there. All around me were the stars, including powerhouse artists Celine Dion, Mary J. Blige, Patti LaBelle, and Gwen Stefani. For years, I'd been inspired by their work, and it felt so strange to have them greet me with, "Hey, Alicia." I was like, "How do you even know who I am?" The entire experience was as if I were suddenly being inducted into a society club that I'd never officially pledged. I have no clue what I said to anyone. My body was there, but my head was someplace else. I had that same inside the TV feeling I'd experienced on Oprah's set. Pure bliss. That's the only way I can describe performing Fallen, as some of the greatest musicians of all time sang along from the audience. My flamenco-infused performance medley was lifted by the talents of Joaquin Cortez, who danced alongside me as I played and sang, struggling to keep my lids from snapping shut, half high from the mix of adrenaline and flu meds, and pretty sure I was forgetting some of the dozens of flamenco steps we'd practiced so hard beforehand. We all come into the world blessed with a unique gift, And I've always known that dancing will never be mine. I can move, I can groove, I can float, I can vibe, but I was never meant to be out there on stage doing dozens of orchestrated moves with 20 dancers behind me. It's not my thing. Yet there I was, sharing the stage with a world-class flamenco badass, and though I flubbed a few moves, I was not about to mess up my moment. Before the ceremony, I'd already won 2 awards off camera. And then, in the arena that night, my name was called again, and again, and again for a total of 5 of the 6 Grammys I'd been nominated for. When my name was announced as the winner of the Best R&B Album Award, I rose and walked to the stage, both ecstasy and sheepishness on my face. What new artist wins 5 awards after just 1 album? Given the extraordinarily talented musicians who were nominated alongside me, my series of wins felt unbelievable to me, even otherworldly. This award right here, I'm very honored for, I said, with my hand over my heart and my palm clutching the golden gramophone. I would like to dedicate this to just thinking out of the box, to just not being afraid to be who you are, no matter what anybody says. Coloring outside the lines is what had led to that stage, along with another force far greater, Providence. Part of my journey, as I see it, has been guided by spirit. It's a rickety upright that suddenly becomes available in the spring of 1987. It's a vocal coach who spots a girl group and mentions them to his brother. It's a teenage dreamer roaming the streets of the village and crossing paths with someone who will share in her musical destiny. Some might call it coincidence. I call it divine order. Chapter 7, Diary Notes.
Hello, this is Lee Blake. I'm the co-founder of Keep a Child Alive, Alicia's first non-profit.
Music, not fame, has always come first for Alicia. When she and I sat together on a plane ride back from South Africa, we talked a lot about the madness of celebrity, the mobs of screaming fans, the onslaught of attention. She appreciated the world's embrace of her music, of course, but she was struggling with what that meant for her personal space. Keep a Child Alive, the nonprofit we started in 2003, gave Alicia a way to use her extraordinary platform as a force for good. To travel to Africa in your early 20s, to meet people there who radiate incredible strength and kindness amid such great suffering, and then to return home with a strong mission for how you can have an impact, that really fed Alicia. It also imbued her fame with a profound sense of purpose.
Fame comes in many colors. One is an electric purple, the shade of a vibrant euphoria that fell over me when songs in A minor reverberated. That initial rush of exhilaration eventually morphed into another color, a drab gray, a sense of overwhelming intrusion and the slipping away of privacy and stillness. I vacillated constantly between the two hues, the exultation and deep gratitude that came with people connecting with me and my music, and the frenzy brought on by the applause. Amid this seesaw of realities, my instinct was always to hide my gray zone from the world. Until now. Sometime between my first album and my second, I began grappling with an existence that felt so strange to me. Imagine if, for 2 decades, you'd been going to the same grocery store, filling your cart with produce while minding your business. Now imagine one afternoon going into that same store and having literally every person, from the shoppers to the cashiers, staring hard as you pick out your strawberries. At first, you might stand there feeling a mix of delight and disbelief at others' curiosity. But if that scene played out month after month, not just in your supermarket, but in every public place you visited, the novelty would soon wear off. You'd be no less thankful for the love, but you might find yourself yearning for sweet anonymity. That time when you'd been able to roll out undetected in your raggedy sweats, blissfully oblivious to all but the beats bumping through your earbuds. This loss of anonymity became my new normal, my gray zone. Every person who lives under this microscope deals with this reality, this grayness of the glory in his or her own way. I was the girl accustomed to disappearing for hours in Joplin's ragtimes or immersing myself in my diary, and I initially pulled back from the recognition. And yet that desire to step away was at odds with an urge just as powerful in me, the desire to be liked, to be seen as the nice girl, to accommodate others, even if that meant dismissing my own needs. That tendency had been years in the making, sprouting up in two very fertile conditions. A childhood spent as a chameleon, shifting constantly to keep my mother more calm than fiery. And a world in which women for generations have been conditioned into voicelessness, where their opinions are cast aside dismissively, the expectation being that they accommodate others and put their own